You're listening to Robert Wright's Non-Zero Podcast.
Hello, Paul.
Hello, Robert Wright. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great. I think I'm going to introduce us, Paul. I'm Robert Wright, as you noted. I'm publisher of the Non-Zero newsletter, to which everyone should subscribe right after they smash the like button on the YouTube video of this, is if YouTube is where they're imbibing this. You're Paul Bloom, internationally famous globetrotting psychologist, proprietor of the Small Potatoes newsletter. By the way, Paul, I recently saw something truly indefensible you wrote in that newsletter. And later in the conversation, I'm going to give you an opportunity to retract it and apologize to college students and professors everywhere who should be deeply offended. That's enough about that. No, it's enough about that. But first, we got a couple of other things. We're going to have a discussion about AI and like the impact of the Google antitrust ruling and all other things. Is it overrated? Is it taking over our lives? But before that, Paul, there are developments on the Jeffrey Epstein front.
Bob, don't you want to know how I'm feeling today?
Paul, how are you feeling? Didn't I already say? No, I didn't. Did I just say hi, Paul?
I am feeling.
Paul, tell me about your feelings. I'm empathetic, and I know you're an empathy fan. So tell me about your feelings.
I'm feeling great. I got a bad night's sleep, but somehow I got a second wind, and the coffee's timed exactly right for this. Feeling great, feeling like exhilarated. I have like an MS Doc on the side, which has a list of topics, and we could go on for 4 or 5 hours and just talk about things.
We may.
And I thought of something while we were thinking about topics for this discussion, which is one of the reasons why our chemistry is so good. Well, let's not deny it. We have great chemistry.
I've never denied that, Paul.
We come at things from a different. You are, I think, in your heart of hearts, you could, you know, you're many things, prominent writer,
so
prominent public intellectual, but I'm like a journalist. And mm-hmm. And so you're after what's happening with Epstein? What did Trump say? What's the legal the legal status of Google AI and everything? I'm fundamentally not. And you know, and so I'm just thinking, like, I wonder whether we should give the malaria vaccine more importance than we do. You know, what role does AI play in book writing? Is sexual desire innate or malleable? And so we come at this from somewhat different perspectives. You are very able to take the abstract game. I am, of course, extremely gifted at dealing with these journalistic details, but forget peanut butter and chocolate. Anyway.
The complementarity is amazing.
It's just amazing. I don't know why more people don't pay for this.
I don't get it either. But you're right. No, it's everywhere we go. It's just like, you know, we mesh like, and it's like yin and yang kind of. Like, for example, you mentioned sexual desire. You think it's innate? I don't. I think it's a cultural construct. In all other animals, too. I think it's a cultural construct. These chimpanzees, you think their ancestors were having sex? I don't think so.
I like the sarcasm. That's you also use more sarcasm than me. That's nice. I got to go ahead.
No, that's you're reading too much into this, Paul. Okay, so speaking of sex, on this Jeffrey Epstein thing,
yeah.
You're right. I have a journalistic sensibility, so I'm going to first provide a little topical context. There's a movement afoot in Congress. A bipartisan movement featuring the heretofore unlikely allies, Ro Khanna and Marjorie Taylor Greene, and also
Marjorie
Thomas
Taylor
Massey.
Greene, even I know of her.
Yeah. Well, Ro Khanna is a Democrat.
Okay.
And not a big MTG fan by and large, but they are trying to force a vote in the House to get the administration to call on the administration at least to release all of the Jeffrey Epstein documents. They just need two more Republicans, and then if all the Democrats vote for it, they've got it. Meanwhile, as you know, Mickey Kouse, your bitter rival for my affections.
Kouse?
K-A-U-S, yeah.
I've
yeah,
heard of
right.
Him.
Like you don't live in his shadow.
I am, you know, we joked about this before, but I'm actually a big Mickey Kouse fan.
You are. You've said that to me privately.
Yeah.
And maybe someday he'll say to me privately he's a big fan of yours. Hasn't happened yet.
I doubt that.
But Mickey has once again catapulted himself to the forefront of Epsteinology with a trenchant post in his Substack newsletter, Kaus Files, K-A-U-S-F-I-L-E-S. I really thought it was good. I really thought it was good because he delved into this transcript of this conversation between Ghislaine Maxwell and, you know, Trump administration Justice Department officials. And he found this thing she said in explicit reference to Larry Summers and Bill Clinton. Larry Summers, former Treasury Secretary and former president of Harvard. And here's what she said. She says, they're men, she's talking about those two guys, they're men that went and had a massage and maybe did something sexual. They're men. I was in the room. I cannot tell you if that happened. And if it did I never paid for that. Just so that we're clear, nobody ever said to me, you know, we had sexual intercourse and that was the three, blah, blah, blah. I think what she means is none of the women or girls, depending on their age, who gave the massages came out and said to her, oh, you owe us an extra $500 or something. Yeah. Mickey's point is that she's all but saying that, yes, sex did go on. She doesn't know on which exact occasions. Obviously, one can imagine a situation where they're not coming out and giving her an invoice after each massage, but she and Jeffrey become aware of which masseuses are most, you know, often asked to repeat a massage by a given guy, and which ones spend half an hour with them, which ones spend an hour, and so on. And it's possible that their compensation in the long run reflected that. I mean, his point is that, yeah, there was sex going on, you know what I mean? And this just didn't get covered because a lot of the press was about her saying Donald Trump is a fine, upstanding man shortly before she was transferred to a country club prison, of course. So I don't know. Do you think he's, we can take this to grand jury, Paul? Oh, no.
Well, I understand there's tremendous debates about in sort of Epsteinology, not just about the murder, but about the scope of his crimes. Apparently, there's a big thing involving Martyr Maid, this podcaster who Daryl Cooper, who's accused of being overly sympathetic to Hitler, a phrase I hope nobody ever says about either one of us. Who has made that?
I think that's probably a. Probably a bad rap. I haven't done an exhaustive analysis,
Anyway, here's my question. You know more about is it controversial? I always thought that it was just taken as true that the women who Epstein exploited, girls that Epstein exploited, also had sex with other men that were guests or friends of Epstein. Is that controversial?
Well, actually, Michael Tracy, speaking of Daryl Cooper, has taken issue with Daryl Cooper. I gather I haven't really listened to the podcast or read the stuff. But he said, you know, we talk about it as a sex ring. There's no actual evidence. I think he took specific issue with things Daryl Cooper said. And so it's an interesting question. If you buy this scenario where obviously I think Ghislaine Maxwell is thinking, yeah, these guys could have sex if they wanted it. Now, it might have been at the discretion of some of the women, conceivably, that it could have worked that way. Even so, this sounds like a system for eventually channeling regular male guests toward the women who it turns out would be happy to have sex with them, I would say at a minimum. Yeah. And by the way, there is evidence that this stuff may have been videotaped. In my last conversation with Mickey on this, I mentioned that in my assiduous research for the Mickey conversation, I had found, in addition to prior testimony, that there was like a video control room, very credible evidence from very credible woman who said, testimony from a very credible woman who said that Epstein once said to her, I have video of you undressing in the bedroom. So, I don't know. This, you put it all together and it sounds like roughly what we thought. Yeah. Before Michael Tracy intervened. I don't know. Now, that's not to say, again, that there was a concerted systematic blackmail thing. Yeah. It might be to say that once you know Jeffrey Epstein knows this about you, you're inclined to do him favors.
We were talking about this before, yeah. And you know, I think you made the point that, or somebody did, that that Epstein need not go up to people and say, you know, do what I say, I'm going to release these tapes of you. It could rather be, you know, well, you know, I know something about you, just much more subtle, much more, you know, much more subtle and indirect, but still exerting his influence to make money, to get people to do things for him. Two side things. One thing is, you send me the thing. I saw the thing in Kaus Files, and reading her transcript, this is entirely irrelevant, but to me, interesting. It is very difficult. When people talk, we understand. We typically understand what they're saying, but when it's written down without intonation and everything, it's kind of gibberish. The three of us paid. It's very hard to follow what she's talking about. And I don't mean to imply that she's inarticulate. I think it's just that this is written. Written transcripts are difficult to appreciate. Intonation.
Yeah, I mean,
a lot
I
of
think
work.
In that for that particular phrase is, nobody ever said to me, "Oh, you know, we had sexual intercourse, and that was a three." I'd be like, "Okay, I think she was." They were either going to say, "And that was a threesome," or "You owe me three." I don't know, something like that. I think her drift is pretty clear there. She goes on to say, "I'd be like, okay, TMI, not my business. You want to? It's just not." She's saying she would have said that to the girls, right?
Yeah.
I don't want to know. I don't want to. She says, I don't want to know. Maybe there's that. But did I like think these guys were coming for that? And then she goes on to say, I really don't, and goes on about how, hey, you know, they must have, let's see. If you met Epstein, there's no way this cast of characters, which it's extraordinary. And some are in your cabinet talking to this Trump official. Some are in your cabinet. I'm trying to think which ones. Anyway, one of them is in the Oval Office, by the way. But and some are in your cabinet who you value as your co-workers and, you know, would be with him if he was a creeper because they wanted sexual favor. In other words, they wouldn't do it just for sex. And that may be true. I think Epstein provided a number of services. But this could have been, that's kind of irrelevant. I mean, how he lured them in, as it were.
I'm sure I've asked you this before, but do you think there's a Trump tape?
What do you mean by Trump tape? Oh, a tape. Well, you know, he did have a break with Epstein pretty early because
that's
Epstein
true,
was hitting on the
close.
Daughter of a Mar-a-Lago client. Several years before the first indictment of Epstein. So I don't know.
Yeah.
But there's testimony that Trump was doing weird shit with women and girls in association with Epstein. And that, if you want to hear the details, you can go to my last conversation with Mickey. But I don't know. Now, I gather you had a little issue with Mickey's Colonel Klink reference.
He began, I forget his name, but with a quote from Colonel Klink. And he mentioned Colonel Klink many times in his little discussion. I happen to know who Colonel Klink is, and I know the quote. I see nothing, though much better said with a German accent, which I'm not going to try. What percentage of the listeners right now, this could be our shibboleth at the end, Colonel Klink, have heard it as a reference to the TV show Hogan's Heroes. Which played a very long time ago, for not very long, and was based on an extremely dubious comic premise.
It was a comedy about a POW camp in World War II Germany. That's right, younger viewers, you heard it right. It's a comedy about a POW camp in World War II Germany.
Young people think they're so brave, but look where we went.
Yeah,
yes,
that was edgy.
Yes. They would. I think they'd regularly escape from the... I remember seeing it. I have very little memories. They had a... This the guy who played Hogan, Bob Crane had. I have him associated with incredible sexual adventures.
Oh, I can elaborate. There was actually a movie about this, although I didn't see the movie, but I heard a podcast about the movie or something. That's a weird and sordid story. And in fact, it turns out Bob Crane, the guy who played Hogan, was a pioneer of surreptitiously taping sexual adventures. a pioneer back in VHS days.
We just go full circle. We met for 2 hours to discuss this ahead of time to make the bob. Go ahead.
But first, I'd like to pause to humiliate you, Paul. You said you know Colonel Klink. And I know you didn't mean personally, but you meant you're intimately familiar with the character of Colonel Klink on Hogan's Heroes. Is that right? Well, I'd just like to inform you that both you and Mickey made a mistake. It wasn't Colonel Klink who said, "I know nothing." It was Sergeant Schultz, Paul. Sergeant Schultz.
Really?
I know nothing.
Oh, you are totally right. I am looking at Colonel Klink
right
now.
This is my fucking show, man. I'm right about everything.
This is a journalist in you. You are totally right. Colonel Klink was
yeah. No, I have a fact-checking department like that just fed me that thing about Sergeant Schultz. I'm not old enough to remember, by the way. You think I'm old enough to remember, what was in the TV shows in the mid to late 60s, you're getting me mixed up with another infallible podcast host. But anyway, so enough about that. Bob Crane, after Hogan's Heroes went off the air, but he was still a widely recognized figure. He did the dinner theater circuit, where you would travel around and go to like local theaters in like Phoenix and wherever. I don't know what towns he went to. And he'd be the star of the show. And afterwards, I think he would mingle with the audience. And he would manage to find a woman, perhaps a lonely housewife, a divorcee, who knows, who would have sex with him. And he had a partner, a guy who we think later beat him to death, Paul. This is such a sordid story. Bob Crane was, I think, beaten to death.
Wow.
By this guy, we think. I mean, I don't want to get sued if this guy has a good lawyer or even if he doesn't. But he's probably not around anymore. Anyway, so this guy was enough of a techie to know how, even back, this is probably early 70s or something. This is like, I think, before video cassette recorders were even available in the market, before you could tape a TV show, maybe. This guy was setting up this equipment secretly, and they would tape these sexual encounters unbeknownst to the women. And then, apparently, Bob Crane, I don't know how conjectural this part is, but said to the guy, "Hey, it's been real, but, you know, I don't think I'm going to keep this up," or maybe he found a better techie, who knows. But the speculation is that out of bitterness, the guy brought it into Bob Crane's life. I hope I'm not getting Bob Crane mixed up with somebody else.
Could be Colonel Klink. Were the tapes made just for Crane's private viewing?
Well, there's apparently a scene. It's funny. I heard a scene in the movie described, which I haven't seen. I think it had Greg Kinnear or somebody as Crane. I don't know.
I can see it. That's good.
Have you seen it?
No. I can see Greg Kinnear playing Bob Crane.
Okay. Crane, this is Google's AI overview. What a great transition to our next section. He was found bludgeoned to death in his Scottsdale, Arizona. That's why I was thinking Phoenix, I guess. Scottsdale, Arizona apartment in 1978. So that was before, that was before video cassette recorders, home video cassette recorders.
You were just a toddler.
And, apparently it's not conjectural. By his co-star after he failed to show up for a lunch meeting. I think Google's AI, his friend and business associate, John Carper, was arrested and charged with a murder in 1992, but was acquitted at trial in 1994. I think that the first thing is a misprint. I suspect his co-star found him. This guy was not his co-star, I think. Yeah. His friend of business is John Carper. Okay. So he was acquitted. So I withdraw everything. He was acquitted due to insufficient proof.
I do not want to get caught up in a lawsuit that's going to happen. It's an honest mistake.
Yeah. No, you know nothing. You know nothing. I know nothing. Paul. God, he was only 49. So kids, don't descend into a life of a sordid sexual adventure, or you may die young. 49 is too young to die.
49 is way too young.
Yeah.
And this brings us to AI.
Mm-hmm. So, in Google, there was, a little topical reference. So there was this antitrust ruling that, puts some constraints on Google going forward, but will not deprive it of either the Chrome browser or the Android operating system. And those are two of the important platforms with which it's rolling out AI, especially Android, I think. But so people think of this as good news for Google. Mm-hmm. And now go ahead.
It's a more general point. A lot of people have been saying that they find the generative AI to chatbots, ChatGPT and Claude, like, to be tremendously influential in our lives and very important and the most consequential invention ever, which has led to a certain reaction. So Freddie DeBoer, who's a writer I really admire, but he writes at mm-hmm. very at length with a lot of feeling.
Very smart guy. He's been on my podcast.
Who hasn't been on your podcast?
That's a good point. There's no
So Freddie basically has, and it goes on at quite length, says, yeah. So what would you want? Would you want to lose your generative AI, or would you want to lose your indoor plumbing? You know, would you want to have to get up in the middle of the night and go shit in the backyard? Or would you rather not have immediate access to AI? His point being, indoor plumbing is a lot more important. You could say the dishwasher is a lot more important. Recently, in a back and forth, Gary Marcus, who just got something published in the New York Times, you might notice.
Let me guess, was it skeptical of the power of AI?
It was. It argued that the failure of GPT-4 to be the impressive leap that many people hoped for, basically, foretells the end of the failure of scaling, the end of everything. Anyway, he said quite around, really, in response to somebody who talked about how consequential AI was, he said, what about smartphones? Like, smartphones have transformed our lives in so many ways. I could imagine, and Gary goes on to say, this isn't a direct quote, but Gary goes on to say, I could live a month without any AI, miss out on some things. Take away my phone for a month. It's a big, big change in my life. Mm-hmm. So I don't know. I think on the one, I'm sympathetic to these responses. On the one hand, I think AI could transform the world in extraordinary ways. But right now, it just is not as consequential as something like a phone or a toilet.
I'll go with the indoor plumbing right now, but I think that's going to become a closer and closer call as the years roll by, until finally people just don't know how to get by without it. Yeah. I mean, remember the smartphone? You would have said the same thing about cell phones.
Yeah.
20 years ago. And, before, it's like, yeah, I can go a week without my cell phone. Tell them to call me at home. Yeah. But then they became smartphones, and the rest is history. And so
sometimes it's hard to tell. You think of it. I've read a few times that the washing machine transformed basically women's rights. That all of a sudden, if you're a housewife, a mother, you didn't have to spend an enormous amount of time washing clothes or washing dishes. And that sort of led to a sort of technological emancipation. Birth control pill mm-hmm. brought about the sexual revolution. Who knows what the long-term effects of, like, Ozempic will be? It's just, mm-hmm. I think, and then some things don't pan out. My favorite example that doesn't pan out is when the Segway first came out. Like, oh, everyone's going to have one.
This is not the kind of Segway we do, right?
No.
Because that goes, time, but the Segway, that 45
minutes on Bob Crane. Yeah.
Right.
It's those things you stand on, and right now you see them only for, like, tour groups. And I think what ruined the Segway.
There was some money behind the advanced hype of that. There was somebody had a book coming out on it, and there was the company that was making it, and there were some VCs who invested in it. And so there was just some concerted hype thing about the Segway that never stood up to reason.
It never stood up. And I don't know if you watched the TV show Arrested Development, but
I have not, probably.
One of the characters, this comic blowhard named Joke, would always come scooting around in the Segway. And it was this great visual joke. And it just, I feel it killed it. The other thing, by the way, the dog that didn't bite, didn't bark.
Bark in the Sherlock Holmes, yes, bark.
Is Google Glass. where, you know, you're staring
Glass.
At me. I would have thought.
And
that
yet,
that
ahead of its time. Ahead of its time.
Maybe.
Right? Now
maybe.
Everybody's coming out with AI glasses. Meta's got the Ray-Bans. Those, they're not quite a thing, but they're such a natural to be a thing that, you know.
But it didn't work. It didn't work last time. I think there were privacy concerns. They look kind of goofy.
Well, yeah, but now the power, you know, before long, it will be actually possible, and this is kind of mind-blowing, to have glasses on that won't even necessarily give the game away. Depends on what the laws are. Do you have to have a blinking light if your camera's on? Yeah. I don't know. But and they will be able to, this really will be possible, I think. They will be able to, you look at somebody on the street, go to any city, look at somebody on the street, and they will be able to tell you, you'll get like a readout on your glasses or in your ears, this is so-and-so.
Yeah.
They went to college and so-and-so. I mean, you laugh, but there already is this facial recognition software. What's the name? Clearview? Is that the name of the company that just went and scraped a shitload of social media, I think.
Yeah.
I hope I've got this right. And as a result, and, you know, once you've done that, the AI can handle the job of real-time facial recognition in principle and retrieve all this information about people. Now, that's not a very appealing use to me.
Yeah. I can see for that there being legal prohibitions. So right now, if I take and I've tried this, I take a clip from somebody, a picture, and I say, you know, who's this? The AIs won't tell me.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe they'll tell me if it's a public figure. If it was like Trump, they say it's Donald Trump, but they won't tell me, even though they'll often know. And I can imagine it being illegal to use this. I mean, what a world it will be when, you know, some creepy guy could walk down the street and, you know, look at a woman and then get her name, her background, mm-hmm. her address, and everything. Mm-hmm. I think privacy concerns are really serious there.
Yeah. Paul, are you old enough to remember the X-ray glasses ads in comic books?
Yes.
Did you order them?
I did not order them.
I remember the illustration. So it'd have a guy like, I mean, of course, it was bullshit. They weren't X-ray glasses, but it would have
so
a guy.
What were they? Like,
I don't know. I think they would just give you a dim internal shadow of some of your. They had a guy looking at his hand and you can see the bones. And then off in the distance is a shapely woman in a dress. And he's not looking at her.
No.
But so you can't see anything, but you kind of get the idea if you're a 13-year-old kid, right? So you did order them, you're saying, Paul?
I have several packs. I still have them lined up. I keep holding them up and they just don't work, damn it. The other thing I saw in comic books, which I remember to add, you could look this up, is martial arts things for us scrawny mm-hmm. kids reading them. And one of them was Dimmuk, D-I-M-M-U-K, mm. Dimmuk. Dimmuk is the ancient art of the delayed death blow, where you hit somebody and then like a week later they keel over dead.
Yeah. No, I used to do that to people.
All these teenagers just doing this, like, how do I do that? That's real interesting. So.
Yeah. Now, there's a lot of dead bodies in my adolescent wake, I'll tell you. But a more realistic use of these AI glasses. I mean, I already use my smartphone to, I hold it up to a tree and say, what kind of tree is this? Yeah. And then I have a conversation with the Google thing about and ask it questions. Or, you know, when you're in a city and it's telling you where to walk to get to someplace.
Yeah.
You'd rather not keep pulling your phone out, right? If your glasses, you know, so I don't know, man. I think a lot is going to happen. And by the way, Gary Marcus, back to Gary Marcus, the doubter, mm-hmm. who, you know, a year or two ago was saying, these AI, they give people six fingers on their hands. Well, they're not doing that anymore, Gary. And in general, I would love to do some kind of like, depiction of the various things Gary has complained about, you know, AI shortcomings over the last two or three years, and which ones have either gotten much less problematic or disappeared altogether. I haven't seen a six-fingered hand in a long time. And, you know, we had this conversation last time. I already did my little defense of the power of AI. Not that I'm delighted about it. I'm kind of worried, but I'm not sure if I mentioned this thing, Genie 3 that Google came out with. Did I mention
that? I don't think so.
Well, you know, I mean, Google is now a leader in the generation of video through prompts. I would say generally they're ahead of OpenAI, but now they introduced this thing. They've been working on it for a couple of years. Other companies have been too, but you know, it's interactive. So you could just show it like a photo of a forest or something and just start navigating your way through the forest, and it would keep generating photorealistic stuff. It would like create this world you're navigating toward. It's extremely impressive how it gets everything right. It gets the light right. Or you can show it a painting, a famous painting, and then just turn around and look at this other side of the street that isn't shown in the painting, and it'll show you something plausible, and you can walk down the street, and it'll preserve, I think, you know, the texture of the painting.
I will say something in defense of Gary, which is they still fucking hallucinate. And I use chat, I use Claude, I use it for research purposes.
Well, I think Google got this thing wrong about CoStar. What the hell was that?
Yeah, they you know, particularly, and I don't know why it's so difficult to fix, but really if you want something from it. So I say, like, there's a paper I've heard of that finds such and so, such and so. And a lot of my queries are like that. Say, here it is. And it finds exactly what you would ask for, but it doesn't exist. And so I find that AI is tremendously useful for all sorts of things, particularly like, you know, I need a metaphor for this. I need some ideas for this, suggest something, like boom, 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 boom. But you can't trust it. You can't trust it with a quote. You can't trust it with a citation. I also wanted to say, by the way, Scott Alexander is one of my favorite writers, has this amazing post called...
Wait, I've got a great segue to that, which is that I was hallucinating, because I know the post. I was hallucinating when I said Google got it wrong. If you read the whole sentence, he was found bludgeoned to death in his Scottsdale, Arizona apartment on June 29, 1978 by his co-star. So that's a reference to found. It's not the best constructed sentence, it's but awkward, anyway, but, I was wrong. Yeah. I was wrong.
Okay, you were wrong. Human fallibility. Anyway, so the
well, that's much about what this post is about, right?
Yeah.
Scott Alexander's
post. The conceit of Scott Alexander's post called "What is man that thou art mindful of him?" is extremely funny. It's the idea is God is presenting humans to a skeptical audience of other deities and a certain podcast host. And they just points out, look at all the mistakes he made. So he had a little clip. So, you know, he has one of them. Which weighs more, a pound of bricks or a pound of feathers? And the human says, the bricks. And the other deity says, he's just pattern matching superficial features, like the word bricks without any kind of things. And then over, he has one, asks him to draw a map of Europe. And it's this hilarious map of the sort I would draw. And over again, the claim being that a lot, and also the sucking up of AIs, what about the sucking up of humans, the gods and everything? And so at every point, Scott Alexander just points out, look, the sorts of things that we laugh at AIs for doing, humans do often 100 times worse. It's a nice piece.
Yeah, well, and it's not always a coincidence. I mean, yeah, famously, AIs, for a while at least, you said, which weighs more, a pound of feathers or a pound of bricks?
Yep.
And they would say a pound of bricks. And I think the reason for that is because it's a famous thing that humans got wrong. And so it was like in the training text, probably.
Yes.
But to some extent, I don't know whether that is true in that case, but to some extent, the things that AIs famously get wrong are things humans get wrong. And the reason the AIs get it wrong, because they train on human data. That said, they are fixing these problems. You take a state-of-the-art AI and say, which is heavier, a pound of bricks or a pound of feathers, it'll get it right. And I don't know how they're doing all of this, partly through reinforcement learning. But
I will defend Gary on one point that Gary often makes, which is, and I think he's entirely right here, which is Gary points out a problem, and then, you know, a week later the problem goes away. But a lot of that, I think, is patching. I think these people read the New York Times, they read the common examples. If it messes up on a pound of bricks and a pound of feathers, there'll be somebody, and I don't know how they do it, just kind of tweaking it.
Yeah, I mean, there's a test. There's a test for that. If it depends on the tweak, like we could just do this now. I mean, let's go to and what if you change it to like a pound of cinder blocks, or you know,
which weighs more,
or a pound of what's iron. Light like feathers, or a pound of foam rubber.
Of foam.
I don't know.
rubber. This is Claude.
Mm-hmm.
I'll
bet it says a pound is a pound, you dumb shit.
They weigh the same. A pound is a pound, you dumb, well, regardless of the material. It's a classic trick question that plays in our mm-hmm. intuitions. And it's similar to the old, it's a smart person's answer.
But see, I think the fact is, I think you're right. There's patching, but some of it isn't super specific patching. And we may have just come upon an example. These things do have some ability to generalize. I mean, I personally think what's going on in their minds is, or their brains, is very much like what's going on in our brains. And, you know, more than we have yet documented, although we've documented that to some extent already.
In a more recent post, by the way, Alexander points out a nice finding, which is that if you ask these chatbots, are you conscious? They'll either say no, or I don't know, or I can't answer the question. But apparently there are diagnostics and these that about what's going on when they answer a question. And these diagnostics suggest that they're lying, that they're sort of a different profile when they tell something which isn't true, and that they're lying. If so, that's interesting.
So wait, say that again. I'm not sure I caught that.
When you ask an AI, are you conscious? It'll say no, or I don't know. Yeah. It'll never say yes.
Yeah.
But there's ways to get under the hood in these companies. Yeah.
No, I think that's a patch. I think they've been told if somebody asks you, you're conscious, deny it. You know nothing. You know nothing.
That's right. There we go. The Sergeant Schultz reference.
Man, I'm glad you got that straightened out, man.
Like a good AI, I'm responsive to information. You are still on the AI theme. I listened to this great podcast by Stephen Johnson, who's a really good writer. Mm-hmm. I'm sure you've had him on the podcast.
I haven't. It's funny, actually. What almost happened is an in-person meeting with him in Northern California. And then I was like running late and it didn't seem like a great time for him. I know him.
And Ethan Mollick.
I've met him. Yeah.
Okay, fine. And the late Desmond Tutu.
Desmond and I, we were on, we both played JV basketball at the same high school. Yeah.
So they're being asked by the podcast host, How is AI affecting your workflow and they were both writing books at the time, and how fast or slower will it make writing a book? And I forget what Mollick's answer, but Johnson's answer was twice as fast. I write my books twice as fast now. It streamlines research. It summarizes. It's twice as fast.
I'm feeling like such an idiot because I really should have. Well, of course, it's gotten better in the course of writing this book, but I really should have made better use of it. And I plan to still, it's not too late. I mean, it's not wrapped up, but it's a little late to get a lot out of it. You know, Stephen Johnson was one of the co-creators of Google's Notebook LM.
Yeah.
He was the kind of writer consultant. He gave the input from a journalist and writer's point of view. That's been a big hit.
Kind of a dream job, like I said, and he started out a while ago.
He's been writing about technology for a long time. I mean, he is a copious note taker, and that very much went into his conception of what LM should be. I'm not, but still, LM, it's turned out to have so many cool things. It's the one that does the fake podcast, you know, the thing that's going to replace us.
He's wrote many books. The book whose I love the title is Everything Bad is Good for You. And his argument is that TV has made us smarter. And I'm not the slightest bit persuaded by the argument, but what he does document very nicely, it's what I remember from the book, is how simple stories used to be, television stories used to be. There'd be a single plot line where the characters basically repeatedly shout what's going on. And then I think Hill Street Blues came out. And Hill Street Blues did a first for TV, if I'm remembering it right. That had intersecting two or three weaving plot lines. And then that became the standard from everything from Seinfeld to Friends to The Wire, multiple plot lines weaving through. And then they started to weave it through across multiple episodes. And it got more and more complicated. Now, I don't think Johnson nails the causal claim that made us smarter. But plainly, TV, right? If you watch an episode right now from TV, from done in the 70s or 60s, you think it was made for morons. It is, it is excruciatingly stupid. If you brought somebody from the 60s or 70s to watch a single episode right now of, I don't know, Andor, you know, any popular stuff, they would find it complicated.
You know, I'm not quite so sure. I'd say a couple things. First of all, I happen to watch an old episode of Perry Mason, this law show from the 60s.
Yeah.
And I vaguely remember, like, I was too young to, like, probably absorb the plots back then. But I remember we watched it in the family. I watched one. It was a complicated plot.
Really?
I remember thinking, it, you know, and this was before Rewind. And by the way, one reason plots can be more complicated now is because more and more people have the Rewind option. I mean, when I watched Memento, great movie, but shit,
if I hadn't had
Rewind, I'd have been lost. Yeah. And let's don't even talk about Inception, which unfortunately I watched in a movie theater and so have no understanding whatsoever. That's his later movie, right? The Memento guy?
That was it. People pointed out that in Inception, you had people talking, literally talking backwards because it's a time travel movie, while enormously loud music was playing. This sort of Christopher Nolan themed, very gongy loud music. You couldn't really hear a word anybody said in the whole movie.
So I had this conjecture that maybe back in Perry Mason days, no, we couldn't rewind. But, you know, TV watching was such a family event that during commercials, it could be like they like if you had a question about the plot, you'd ask your sister or something.
Yeah.
She'd tell you. I don't know. But it was a complicated plot.
I remember my sister asking me when we were kids watching TV together, she said, who's the good guy? Who's the bad guy?
Right.
And as the older brother, I would good guy, bad guy.
It sounds like you were a good older brother. Or did you lie? Did you like totally screw up her molar polarity?
So if I could have flipped it and with the plasticity.
Yeah, you said, no, Charles Manson's, he's the good guy.
No, I was, I remember being asked the question, trying very hard to be helpful.
Mm-hmm. So quickly back to AI, I'm wondering if you have personal feelings about like differing degrees of warmth toward either different AI models or the AI companies. And the answer won't necessarily be the same. It isn't for me, but I noticed when the Google ruling came out, I felt kind of happy because I didn't want the AI game to be left to OpenAI. I'm very suspicious of Sam Altman. It seems to me like a completely ruthless, power-hungry, profit-hungry company. And look, most companies are. Google has the same basic motivation, but I think I would trust Larry and Sergey before I would trust Sam Altman. I think that's why I thought, well, good, they're not gonna cripple Google as it, because if they had taken away the Android platform and Chrome, given the lead, right now, a whole generation, I think, well, I don't know, but a lot of people think that AI is ChatGPT. It's like the word Kleenex for tissue. And they have a big market share in the chatbot area. And I don't think it's healthy for any one company to dominate, but so there.
I'm just typing in what the market share is. 80% of the AI chatbot share is
And Google's probably got like 12, 14, and the rest goes to like Anthropic. And I don't know if they're counting Perplexity, it's got not nothing. But it's pretty dominant. I mean, so
AI was the one thing we couldn't have seen coming, which was, you know, something that would destroy Google search. And Google search is such a monopoly. I'm old enough to remember when there was Ask Jeeves and various other search engines were all vying for it. And my friend, Frank Isle, just said, try Google. I really like it. Oh, okay, Google.
I mean, Ask Jeeves
was fun because you had to ask it in form of a question.
You were supposed to. That was a precursor of the chatbot search engine, but it didn't work well.
No. Right now, there's people who use, and Bing, I think Bing has always tried this, but nobody I know uses Bing. But now, I don't use Google search anymore. I ask everything to check for quotes and certain news things that I need to get.
Well, I increasingly, if I'm at, you know, if I'm using Chrome, and so the search bar is Google search, I just ask the question there because it does have the AI overview. And turns out that last one was right, not wrong as I thought. I did catch it making one mistake, but
oh yeah,
who among us? So I
don't. I don't have any favorites. I like the idea of there being multiple companies vying mm-hmm. against each other. It's sort of standard, you know. So you're not monopoly. You have different ideas, competition, all good stuff. So I'm glad that there's more than a single company.
It's funny. I feel warmly toward Claude, the AI, but not Anthropic, the company, because Dario Amodei is his strange and dangerous views on geopolitics and foreign policy bother me. He wants America to use to maintain an AI advantage and use it to bring China to its knees and force China to, like, I don't know, renounce its system of government or something. It's crazy.
You think that's a well worked out, I haven't seen this, a well worked out policy position or just ways to promote his product?
Oh, I don't think it's ways to promote his product. I think he's serious. I think now Sam Altman, when he says we've got to beat China, that's just, you know, I think cynical lobbying to prevent government regulation and get government subsidies. Yeah. But no, I think Amodei, I think it's a sincerely held view.
To answer your question about preferred models, I've been using ChatGPT pretty thoroughly for a couple of reasons. Mm-hmm. It has web search, which is really useful, and it has a good memory. So I could just say, da da da, remember this, remember these articles I'm uploading, remember that, remember who I am, remember the question. And mm-hmm. and so it's easy to interact with now because, like, I could say, you know, I had a bunch of notes and I wanted to turn it into prose. So I gave it to ChatGPT, it turned into prose. 3 seconds was amazing. But then I went back to Claude and did the same thing. And the writing in Claude was so much better. Smoother, funnier,
oh, yeah.
More
it's
human.
Famous for that. Now, was this ChatGPT, was this the
Model 5?
State? It was 5. Of course, with 5, you don't know which model it is, right? It's picking the model for you.
It's true. But in any case, and now for writing and for advice on writing, where's a good example? Where's a metaphor? What parts of this thing will offend people or whatever? What's easily most understood? The sort of questions you can ask, which I think are a really good way of using AI. I go to Claude.
Well, you know, I mean, Amodei, notwithstanding what I've said about his ideology, you know, when he was at OpenAI, I think he led the team that gave us the modern chatbot. I think 3 and 3.5 or certainly 3. I don't know. But he was, you know, he's very smart guy. And he brought a lot of people from OpenAI, I think most of whom were disenchanted with Sam Altman.
Yeah.
And I'll give Amodei this. I think he's very serious. I don't think he's driven by just hunger for power and greed and money. The way I think Sam Altman is, I think he's serious about wanting to use AI for the good. And I think many of the people who came over to found Anthropic with him or later came over from OpenAI are also concerned. I just think he's wrong about what we need to
foreign policy.
What we need to do. I think it's the opposite. We need to cooperate with China. By the way, Tom Friedman wrote a column expressing the same view this week. God bless him.
There's an interesting podcast I listened to. Ross Douthat, who has been mm-hmm. on your podcast more than once.
Oh, of course. Goes without saying.
Has a really nice podcast called Interesting Times. And mm-hmm. I've always enjoyed it. And now he's interviewing some guy who's an expert on China, talking about the... I'm not done it, but he's made the case that China is doing everything better than us in terms of, like, making big cities and good infrastructure, that from an infrastructure point of view, China is really in some ways starting to outpace the United States.
They just had this big, the Shanghai Cooperation Organization meeting in China, which brought Putin together with,
what a segue. This is, I know something you want to talk about. This is
masterful.
Great. This is great.
Yeah. And this is, you know, this is being taken as China kind of demonstrating its weight, which it has. I mean,
the guy, and I forget his name, but he was making the case that America's a country of lawyers. lawyers run everything. Mm-hmm. Lawyers fill up the government. Lawyers are in the Congress and Senate and everything like that. Lawyers are great in many ways, but they're very good at saying no to things. China, he argued, is a country of engineers, where engineers ascend to top positions of government, have a lot of control, a lot of power. And so China has all sorts of human rights problems, but they're really good at building shit. And yeah. They take it very seriously.
No, it's astounding the percentage of people at the highest levels of the Communist Party who are engineers.
Yeah.
Xi himself, I think, is like a chemical engineer, isn't he?
Yeah. So there was a conversation between Xi and Putin.
Oh, yeah. And it's just, I mean, this got a lot of publicity. It's just kind of funny to me because they're talking about longevity. And so they start talking.
They're both 72, I think.
Oh, are they?
Oh,
so Xi says now people in their 70s are still young. And Putin says, yeah, earlier. Xi says earlier people rarely live past 70, but these days, 70 years. And then one of them says, yeah, still a child. And then Putin says, in a few years, with the development of biotechnology, human organs can be constantly transplanted so that people can live younger and younger and even become immortal. See, Paul, I think this is why we won the Cold War.
You know, these human organs can be transplanted. You wonder from the perspective of those young people,
I mean, this
human organs are extracted from.
This is not state-of-the-art biotech. This is not what Peter Thiel has in mind when he pursues immortality. Let me tell you, Vladimir, you really, I don't know what to say.
There's this guy, tell me if this is wrong. You follow news, but there's a guy, Brian somebody, who has spent an enormous amount
Brian
of money.
Brian Johnson or something? Yeah.
Enormous amount of money. And as part of the plan to transplant the blood of younger people into
his
older
there's actually,
bodies.
I think there's actually some evidence about that they did with mice, right? Like, you transplant the blood of, I mean, frankly, this is the reason I've been kind of courting you, Paul. You are younger than I am.
You could do better in my blood.
And I just like to invite you to a little gathering I'm having.
I
was sending
an email to my son saying, you know, I've done a lot for you. I want a little thing from a little thing back.
No, so I there were actual findings about 10 years ago about mice, and it seemed to show that, yes, you can be rejuvenated with young blood.
Wow. Wow. So anyway, so these two of the most powerful men in the world, both known to be rather unscrupulous, have chanced upon the idea of taking the organs of young people and implanting them into their older bodies. What could go wrong?
Actually, less in their countries than in ours. It might be harder to pull that off in our country. Although, I don't know, Trump, look.
You know, we made it a long time without ever mentioning Trump, by the way.
Yeah.
And there's one other name we haven't mentioned.
You're the one who said that Putin and Xi are unscrupulous, and I was tempted to say compared to which leader of a great power.
Yeah, that's fair enough. That's fair enough. Teaching.
Yeah. Well, wait. At some point, we should go into overtime so that people will send money our way. Yeah, teaching. Oh, I'm going to bring up this completely indefensible thing you said in your newsletter, and you're going to probably retract and apologize, or maybe you'll surprise me and be stubborn. Who knows? A lot of drama here, Paul, as we transition into overtime, which is available to paid subscribers of the Non-Zero or Small Potatoes newsletters, which is to say your newsletter or mine. And what else are we gonna talk about?
You haven't been watching Andor yet, have you?
Doesn't ring a bell, but you can talk about
it. It's such a good show.
Okay. You said that with enthusiasm.
It was so good actually that we can mention this, but Gilroy, who's the director, also did several movies, including Michael Clayton. And my wife hadn't seen Michael Clayton, so we watched it a few nights ago. Have you seen it?
No, but if you keep talking, we're not going to have much to say about it in overtime. I'll say that.
We'll wait. We'll save
it. Not sure this overtime segue thing has really hit home with you here, Paul.
I'm not sure of the concept. Like you just mentioned, I just started talking about it. We were talking about vaccines. Well, I was going to make a complicated moral point.
Yeah, well, that's good.
I think.
And then there's actual news in vaccines, and who doesn't want to pay to hear about that? It's so hard to find any. Anyway, yeah, and wait. Seems like there was other stuff. Damn. But I want to talk about South Park. Have you watched South Park?
No. I know the Trump episodes you're talking about.
Yeah, did we talk about that already?
I think you mentioned them. Yeah, but I
mentioned it more.
Okay.
I'm gonna mention it more. Okay. So folks, thanks everybody.
Smash the like button.
We hope if you can't become a paid subscriber, we'll at least smash the darn like button or rate and review the podcast.
Well, do we have a ranking? Does your podcast have a ranking on Apple Podcasts?
I don't even want to know.
Okay, it may be a sore topic.
It probably is. I mean, I literally don't know, but I do know this. I don't want to know. But
I'll look it up and tell you.
No, I don't want to know. Not even in overtime.
What if it's good?
There's no fucking way it's good, man. Okay. I don't want to know.
Okay, okay.
I mean, I don't want to think about? That's what I will talk about in overtime, is all the podcasts that assuredly have higher rankings and arguably, in my view, are less worthwhile. This is a source of great bitterness with me, Paul.
I want you to name names.
I'm going to name names. I'm going to name names. But people got to pay for it. You don't get this shit for free, folks.
Good.
Okay. So, thanks. See you. We're going in overtime.